Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schlankhofer, where we talk about all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disaster might affect you, your neighborhood, and your community. There are many threats on the horizon, yet we cannot rely on true and accurate media coverage of many of these issues. These threats are propagated from the mainstream media seeking to tell only one side of the story. In fact, this propagation can even be considered biased propaganda. This is a legitimate threat to you, your family, and our nation, and here on Civil Defense Radio, we seek the facts that others leave out. Remember, your tomorrow may depend on today's preparedness. Now, here is your host, Preston Schlankhofer.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio. I am your host, Preston Schlankhofer, coming to you from the Strategic Command and Control Center deep within Civil Defense Radio bunker. I have a great show for you. My guest today is a friend of mine. He is Cameron Hamilton, retired Navy SEAL, former director at DHS, and now a candidate for U.S. Congress in the 7th Virginia District. He is one of the finest men I know, and it is an honor and privilege to have him on the show. Cameron, welcome to Civil Defense Radio.
Thank you, Preston. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we've talked a few times about coming on the show, but I guess the timing wasn't right, and maybe what we're going to talk about today is the reason why.
That's probably the case.
Yeah. So can you give us a little background so that our friends out there know who you are and what makes you tick?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for having me on the show. So my name is Cameron Hamilton. I'm a former Navy SEAL and former division director at the Department of Homeland Security. I joined the military after 9/11. I served for 10 years in the armed forces as both an operator and a medic in the SEAL teams. And then after my time in the Navy, I transitioned to the Department of State and was an emergency management specialist deploying overseas, protecting U.S. diplomats, principal dignitaries, representatives at the high level with the U.S. government, such as the Secretary of State, congressional delegations, things of that nature. After my time at the State Department, which is about 5 years, I moved over to the Department of Homeland Security and was recruited to become the division director for EMS. By emergency medical services, what I mean is my role was an oversight of roughly 4,000 EMTs scattered throughout the United States and especially along the Southern Border. So my particular specialty with my last line of work has been the border and the border crisis. And so with that being said, as a career civil servant and as a veteran, I have seen intricacies within the United States government, and I've seen some of the bureaucracy and the sickness that plagues it. And so ultimately, a good friend of mine, Nick Freitas, who is also my state delegate here in Virginia, approached me about whether or not I would consider running for U.S. Congress. The reason was because he wanted a principled candidate that would stand for virtue and honor, but also one that was not an establishment type candidate. After some time and prayer and consideration, I ultimately resigned my position and decided to embark on a new future to potentially represent you, the Virginia 7th, as your new state representative.
Let's talk about your time at DHS, because that is near and dear to my heart as a 27-year veteran of Border Patrol and ICE as a immigration officer. What were some of the things that you saw going on with the illegal alien problem down there on the southern border, especially during the COVID period, and what we may be seeing currently and up until the time that you left, and where it may be going?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating topic. At the end of the day, the crisis that we've seen in the southern border, I think, is best described as a humanitarian catastrophe. I don't know how to categorize it any differently than that. We have set forth policies and practices that expedite and facilitate the processing of individuals for immigration's consideration, but we don't actually adjudicate claims at a rate that people would expect. When I say processing migrants, what I mean is individuals have either presented themselves to a sector location, to an actual official crossing point, or they've been apprehended or surrendered themselves to law enforcement somewhere within the United States after having already crossed the border illegally. These are traditionally done in camps or large groups because many regions of the southern border are very difficult terrain to navigate. So that's generally why camp settlements and camp groups and migrant coalitions are better, and your chances of survivability are much higher. So they are apprehended. They are processed by their DNA is examined. their documentation is reviewed, so there's accuracy, and then ultimately they're brought back to a detention center or to a holding facility for further processing. And if they are within the category that we identify, which is the vast majority of them, they are then allowed to continue on their journey within the United States. And many times the United States government actually facilitates and pays for their relocation services under the auspice that one day they will be required to present themselves before a formal immigration judge. The biggest problem with that system in place, and that's a general overview. There's a lot more nuanced language that I'm sure Preston, you and I could talk about much more. That's a general overview. The problem is that when we mitigate the crisis at the southern border, what we do is we deploy additional personnel and resources so that when we intake these individuals, we can intake them faster, but we don't adjudicate their claims faster.
Yeah.
We don't actually evaluate their conditions and whether or not they've met the standards of parole or they've met the standards of validity and their asylum claims to remain in the United States. So many of these individuals come into the United States, are relocated, which, by the way, we pay and facilitate for, Catholic Charities of America, Lutheran, I believe it's called Lutheran Immigration Relocation Services, but I could be wrong about the exact name. We have faith-based institutions and churches that are being paid hundreds of millions of dollars through federal grants to relocate migrants on our behalf under the hopes that they keep a database and consolidated effort of where they go, where they relocate to, so that one day if we need to find them, we can. So there's a business, there's a financial industry that is profiting significantly from the movement of personnel across different lines and regions. Not only that, we have individuals who are willing to endure great physical hardship and pain in the hopes that if they just get to the United States, the blessings of a free democracy and of our capitalistic system here will be pungent in their lives, that it will permeate everything they do, that they'll live better, they'll have better income, better financial opportunities. I don't blame the sentiments there. The problem is, it's created an environment where we are financially incentivizing illegal migration and criminal organizations and syndicates, as well as even faith-based organizations, are profiting from that effort.
Yeah.
So the biggest reason why I call this a humanitarian catastrophe is because these syndicates that move personnel across different states and regions into the United States have no care for the individuals that they're actually responsible for. They will leave migrants periodically at trees or settlements if they're sick or ill and they can't continue on their journey. And every week, there's remains that are found along the southern border by individuals who have been left, who've been given a cell phone and a bottle of water in hopes that, yeah, we hope somebody finds you, but they abandon these individuals there. Number two, individuals that are migrating have spent thousands of dollars, many times per individual. Sexual assault is extremely prevalent. I mean, some statistics, up to a third of all women that come across the southern border have been exposed to sexual assault in some manner along their journey. Number three, these are organizations that simply profit on human suffering. And no moral or virtuous nation would claim that this is a humane thing to do when the driver and the incentive for this environment to begin with has only amplified. In fact, come here now because we can process you faster. That's not a disincentive. That's completely disingenuous to believe as an argument that we're trying to tampon on or suppress some of the illegal migration. It does the exact opposite. We simply open the pipeline faster because now we've given it a bigger hose. So that's probably my summary of how I would describe the southern border. The men and women that are serving down there are some of the most noble and patriotic, hardworking Americans that I have ever had the honor to work with. Having said that, they are given a responsibility and a task that is impossible to do. We are not giving them the resources needed. Our nation does not have the policies in place and practices to effectively manage this crisis. We have not dissuaded the overall incentives. Like I said in my campaign video, we leave members of Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection principally at the business end of bad policy and politics. And it's not fair and it has to change.
Yes, I agree. This is appalling. A friend of mine just retired from Border Patrol after a long career just 2 weeks ago. And then his wife and he went on a long vacation, deserved. But I have contacts still that are active in the fight, so to speak. And a lot of my friends that I worked with, they still live on the border. And so they see the crisis every day. and it's terrible. One of the first jobs that I had when I transferred from Border Patrol to ICE was because I was Border Patrol agent. I dealt with the various Border Patrol sectors that were part of our region. I was the juvenile coordinator. And so I received the juveniles from Border Patrol that were unaccompanied, and then later on changed to family units as well. But we coordinated with Catholic Social Services and Lutheran Services for housing for these unaccompanied minors. And it was not much different then than it is now, except the volume now is much more than what I saw as a deportation officer that was assigned to handle these intakes. Did you have any exposure to the minor crisis?
I didn't. So as a division director for emergency medical services, we got reports routinely about individuals that require a chair while in the custody of DHS, and many of them are children are amazing and resilient in the way that their bodies can compensate for extreme stress. But when we have sick children that are being cared for, it's emotionally invoking, and it should be. That shows the great value that we invest and put in life here. So in 2022, I believe the estimates were 125,000 unaccompanied minors came across the border. That's only about a third of the overall number of minors that we have coming across the border. These are just the ones that were simply not accompanied by a member of their family. And to think about that, I really want people to understand, when I say unaccompanied minors, not all of them are toddlers. I think that's what people sometimes think of.
Right.
But these are children that are not of voting age, that have almost no legal rights the way that an average adult would. They don't have a bank card. They don't have the ability to go rent a vehicle. They don't have the ability to go pay for their own airline ticket. These are individuals who were given over to smugglers by their family.
Yeah.
Because their families are so desperate for financial benefit and profit that they would willingly hand their children over to a smuggler to bring into the United States, never once considering the fact of, will my child be preyed upon? Will my child be victimized? Who will ultimately care for my child? Does this receiving family or relatives even know that they're coming? Are they able to coordinate accurately? We have families giving their children over, paying significant amounts of money to traffic their children in the United States because they believe firmly, if they just get here, if they just come to the U.S., they get health care, they get financial incentives, they get rewards and benefits and assistance from the federal government, which many times they do, and they believe that life will be so much better for their child in the U.S. that they're willing to subjugate one of the most precious demographics of humankind to those stressors. Because we have created an incentive that tells people that's what happens. We've told people, and it doesn't matter what Secretary Mayorkas says publicly, the border is closed, the border is secure. Our policies are saying very much the otherwise. And in fact, we even have nonprofits that have done significant work with the U.S. State Department that are engaged in legal advocacy for migrant groups that are trying to request and find asylum here in the United States.
So I'm glad you brought that up.
The asylum claims have only amplified. You find people who are coached and are prepared into exactly what to say.
Yep.
And ultimately, the point I make, Preston, is human beings are suffering more because they believe they have no other option. That cry for desperation is not something that a virtuous nation would claim as being humane.
I agree.
When I say about securing the border, it's not just because it's a hawkish idea of national sovereignty. That's a significant portion of it. But the other portion is because we deeply care for the well-being of humanity. And we in no way can defend these practices and replicate them as humane, because the amount of privation and desperation people go through and stress to get here is unconscionable. It's completely unforgivable.
Yes, it is. It's being brought home many cities around the nation who have been receiving aliens from the border, and now they're screaming that they have a humanitarian crisis and they're wanting government money to help mitigate the crisis that they, in a way, helped create because they supported the policies of open border.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because even Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City, has come out publicly with a press release. He was speaking at an event, I think it was only a couple of days ago. He literally spoke out and said that New York has over 100,000 illegals within their jurisdiction, 57 or 60,000 of which have come over the past 12 months. And he's made it very clear. citizens of the city of New York are required to house them, feed them, ensure that they have medical care, and educate them. And his point, he literally says in no uncertain terms, this will destroy the city. That's his words. When 12 months earlier, he was outspoken and very vocal about how New York is proud to be a sanctuary city. A sanctuary for what? For human privation? For human desperation? A sanctuary to facilitate criminal activity?
That's exactly what.
On people?
Yeah.
There's nothing sanctimonious. There's nothing benevolent about those policies and practices. So even a state like New York and New York City, its principal city, ultimately has recognized that this is simply unsustainable. We're finding it in Chicago. We're finding it a lot in the 7th District of Virginia. I know we talk about these other locations, but also let me bring it back to people in Northern Virginia. Culpeper County has seen a massive influx of illegal immigration with crime related to gang activity.
Yeah.
Drug houses, the sex trade industry has exploded at rates that have not previously been seen in a long time. That is happening in infiltrating rural communities. We like to think about Northern Virginia, oh, they're in a bubble. It's not staying in Northern Virginia. It's infiltrating the rural communities. It's coming everywhere. Because in fact, a lot of these 95 and Highway 29 corridors have bedrocks and highways to move people back and forth. Right now, in the county of Fairfax, there are 600 human trafficking investigations that are ongoing right now. 600. And yet the media will tell you this isn't a real thing. So there is no such thing as a border state anymore. This problem has infiltrated everywhere, and especially in the 7th, in the eastern half of Prince William County. Is it the 7th is a strange category. We've got Madison County, Greene County, Orange, Culpeper, down into Spotsylvania, Caroline, King George, Stafford, eastern half of Prince William. That is a huge district, 800,000 people. But we are noticing alarming rates of crime in Prince William County. You talk to the Board of Supervisors there, they'll tell you the cold, hard truth about it, about the MS-13 activity that's going on there. We're seeing a lot more crime happening in Stafford County. All the districts and regions that are coming along that 95 corridor are seeing increased and elevated rates of crime. We're noticing it in Culpeper. We're even noticing it in other elements in Spotsylvania and others in Fredericksburg. So the point is, this is not just something that we see in massive cities. This is affecting everywhere. And it is absolutely affecting people here in the Virginia 7th.
Yeah, and people don't realize the depth of the gang activity. A lot of it is within the Hispanic community that never gets to be exposed except through certain high-profile cases that get reported on the local news or something. MS-13 is a pariah. It's been building in every state. Fairfax is the eastern headquarters of MS-13.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. It's just really... it's undefensible. Again, just to be clear, a group like MS-13, their motto is Mata, Viola, Controla, which means kill, rape, control.
Yeah.
These are not migrants that want to come here for a better life in the sense that they just want to live in peace. These are organizations that prey and that profit on human suffering. And our current practices are only amplifying those efforts.
Yeah.
They're not suppressing it.
Yeah.
And I would love to see our Department of Justice and I would love to see our immigration practices reflect more accurately of what the crisis is that we're creating here versus others that we're focused on. We get so caught up in white collar crime. We get so caught up in the financial industry, which is critically important. But there are some serious issues here when it comes to immigration, gang violence, and human trafficking that I think we would have overwhelming bipartisan support in addressing. Unfortunately, we're too focused on national hot topic items rather than addressing the underlying communities that are actually here being impacted.
Yeah. Everything starts local. We have to fight local. We have to build local. And we have to manage the local communities with good law enforcement and policies. But the MS-13 is a national security threat. But so is this immigration, which feeds MS-13's coffers and their strength. So what do you think the future of our nation is and how can we get control of this crisis that we see and where should we be looking for this type of leadership?
We should be looking to Congress to lead because they write some of the legislative policy that ultimately is enacted by the executive branch. When we think about the separation of powers in this country, Congress is given a lot of very unique and enumerated authorities of oversight. And where Congress, I think, has a unique role is in ensuring executive agencies and executive department programs meet the responsibilities of the funding that they've been granted. Congress ultimately controls the purse and the appropriation language. So what I would like to see is members of our current Congress, both of the upper and the lower house, ensure that programs that are funded are engaging in responsibilities that are effective and that are reasonable and that are articulate. I also would like to see us not give so much deference to the executive agencies and the executive branch in general to be subjective on what they prosecute and how. I think our bills need to be more specific in language, easier to understand so as to create very clear guidance. An example of that might be a bill that says, we want this organization to create a committee on this that combats this problem, without actually specifying what the end state objectives are. That is an extremely dangerous piece of legislation, because if you don't codify very clearly what the end state is, it is uniquely up to the individuals employed within the executive agencies or within this executive program to interpret that as they will. That is, in my opinion, a lack of accountability and lack of engagement at the programmatic level. The other problem is Congress passes bills that are so massive, that are so complicated and inundated with legislative language that the average American can't understand. So when we talk about the projects within ORR that are meant to be really benevolent within HHS, well, when HHS's funding is tied to an omnibus bill or tied to other massive spending bills that are so nuanced and so complex, how do we expect the American people to feel engaged and enfranchised to be able to hold members of their government accountable? That's another problem. Congress is uniquely suited to pass bills that are cleaner, that are single items, and that are easily able to be evaluated and audited. So, look, I think we need to put people in power who have better character and who also deeply care for the well-being of humanity, and especially the people of this nation, because that's who we have a responsibility for. I think what that means in the border, we have to tighten down our policies. We have to stop giving so much leverage to the Secretary of DHS and to different organizations that would seek to only provide resources so as to speed up the process, not actually mitigate the crisis that we have. I would like to see us do a full analysis and public audit of all public funds that are spent on that southern border crisis.
That's a great idea.
The American people knew the hundreds of billions of dollars we are spending annually to tampon all this crisis. I think everyone from the inner city communities to the rural farmer of Central Virginia would agree that this is not a sustainable practice, and this is utter nonsense. I don't know that we've been in a position to do that audit, and that's another problem. So I think what we need is legislators who are more effectively engaged, and who also need to hold people like Secretary Mayorkas or other public servants who are paid for by us to account when they lie under oath. Congress also has very specific authorities in this. They are able to hold people in contempt. They are able to censure individuals. They are able to commence impeachment proceedings.
Right.
I think that as much as everyone hates the word impeachment, and I don't like it either, but when you have people grossly misrepresent facts or engaging in a breach of public trust, I think that's where Congress is completely unique in their oversight responsibilities and should engage and should do so relentlessly, so that the American people can feel that their elected representatives strongly advocate for them, not for bureaucrats.
Very well said. It's a huge problem, and we've talked about certain things before, trying to solve the problems of the world, so to speak. But we're going to have to continue doing that, because we don't have the power yet. But once we get more people like you into office, we will have the people's voice heard. And I'm looking forward to you getting into that position so that you can bring a quality that is highly missing in our Congress today.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
Yes.
Well, look, we need help. We need support in whatever way we can. So I would ask that people come to my website, go to CameronHamilton.com. If you're on the fence, if you're not sure, I want you to understand one thing very clearly. I am not an establishment candidate. I'm not going to say things that are going to be popular at DC. And the way I will rule, the way I will expect to be a legislator, will be to return power to we the people. I would ask, if you do one thing, go to my website and check out that 4-minute video that initiates why I'm running, who I am, what character I hope to represent in DC. And then I would ask you to then think about what kind of leaders we put in public office. So the website is CameronHamilton.com. I'd be grateful for any support. I'd be grateful for any partnership. It's time that we bring power back to the people, and that's what we hope to do.
Amen. That'll have to be the last word. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com, right at the top of the page of the resources page. Also, please check out our many postings on Facebook and Telegram. And I have a little bit of a presence that I'll probably get to sometime, put some more of these podcasts up there. But in the meantime, please share and comment where possible to our various posts and our content. And also, we got to beat the algorithm. So the more you like and share and comment, the better we stand and we can reach more people. So I wish to thank my good friend, Cameron Hamilton, again for being on the show. And I want to thank you, our friends out there who are with us on a regular basis. I really appreciate you being with us this week. So please be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.